From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer and naturalist Gretel Ehrlich first went to Greenland in 1993. She went for different reasons, though she had no real idea of where she was going. She ended up spending a good part of her time living with a family of subsistence hunters, people of what she describes as an ice-evolved culture. Ehrlich says the Inuit understand how to move on the ice, and they know it defines their life. Nothing, she writes, is solid. And she kept going back. She says she used the place as a looking glass, part window, part mirror. It helps her describe the real costs of climate change. She's in town talking about that, and Ehrlich is joining us to explain how a warming planet is changing this culture and the old ways of the North and pretty much everywhere else. Join us after the news.
Hey, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard. I'm one of the producers of Radio West. If you like what you hear on the show, you can lend a hand by giving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Facebook. And we'd also really appreciate it if you'd share what you think about the show, or if you have some thoughts about a particular episode, share that stuff around on whatever social media platforms you happen to use. Thanks a bunch and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For a lot of us in the West, when we hear the name Gretel Ehrlich, we think of her book, The Solace of Open Spaces. It's a book that really gets at what it means to live in a landscape that is at once desolate and also, as she's put it, engorged with detail. And that book, in its earliest form, was a series of journal entries she sent to a friend who was raised in Wyoming and who had made what Ehrlich described as the outlandish leap to a tropical climate. She moved to Hawaii. Well, Ehrlich has made her own outlandish leap to Hawaii, and today in the program, she's joining us here in the studio. I should just also tease the fact that she's traveling with her husband, Neil Conan, the former NPR journalist and host, who'll be with us a little bit later on the program. Gretel Ehrlich is in town this week to talk about the impact of climate change on the Arctic, and we'll give you some details about that a little bit later on the program. Gretel Ehrlich is the author of numerous books, as you know, and essay collections, including, as I mentioned, The Solace of Open Spaces. We'll be talking about the book This Cold Heaven as well. And Gretel Ehrlich, welcome to you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So I want to start with your decision to go to the Arctic, to go to Greenland in 1993. And it was a couple of years after you had been struck by lightning, which you write about. But you said you wanted to – you were feeling claustrophobic and you wanted to start seeing horizon lines. Would you explain what it is that made you think you wanted to go to the Arctic at first?
Well, you know, I've been – after I was hit by lightning, I was medevaced to California. I was used to living way out there. I lived on a really remote mountain ranch in Wyoming, in the Bighorn Mountains. I was used to being outside all the time, living a kind of wild and woolly life, and being kind of an invalid, an invalid in the landscape person, was really hard for me. I wasn't physically able to return to the life I had for quite a long time. But I'd also spent a lot of time above treeline. That's sort of my favorite place on the planet. And I'd always thought of treeline as being at, you know, 10, 12, 14,000 feet. And then I was looking at a map one day and I thought, oh, I can get above treeline and still
way
be
above.
At sea level, because I was having trouble going to altitude after my accident. And by chance, I went to a party in Santa Barbara and ran into the editor of Islands magazine, who said, I can't find anyone who wants to go to any of the cold islands. Are you interested in going to Greenland? I said, oh, yes. And she said, would you like to go next week? I said, oh, yes. And I kind of never looked back after that.
What did you envision of the Arctic in contrast to what you encountered? Like, what was the image? What did you think was there? And how did that compare to what was
actually
there?
I had been to Nunavut, the Canadian Arctic, so yeah. I knew what it was going to look like. What I wasn't prepared for was the intimacy of the culture of village life. And I have to say it's very different in Greenland than it is anywhere else in any of the Arctic nations, because they haven't been oppressed in the way that other Arctic people have been. So village life with no cars, just walking paths between places, dog sleds. You go to the – in the old days, you go to the grocery store in Ilulissat, and a dog sled would take you and your groceries home. Dog sleds had the right of way. There were a few cars then there. It was just – to me, it was a dream of living close with people. Children were unhampered. They could run around day or night without being in harm's way. Everybody took care of each other. Everything was shared. It was lovely.
You say in your book, this called Heaven, that the Inuit mind is sharpened by vulnerability. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's real easy to go through the ice and never be seen again. And they know it every day, every minute. And life and death is just kind of right there, as it is in Paris this week. But it's, you know, what it does is wake you up. And so there's a kind of intensity to both the dangers that are everywhere, but also the sense of joy of being alive. And so there's lots of humor, lots of laughing.
Lots of storytelling.
And lots of storytelling, yeah.
I want to have you read a section from this book, if you would, from This Cold Heaven. And I suppose we should set this up. I mean, you describe it as this ice-evolved culture. You were going to travel somewhere, and a friend turned out to be a midwife, says, "Don't go there. Come with us." Essentially, is that the good way to set this up? And here, I want to show you the real Greenland. Is essentially what she was saying.
Well, actually, the midwife was part of the family, but the woman, this couple I met while we were weathered in on our way to Greenland. Yeah. We're from Umanak, and they said nobody travels alone in Greenland. They'll think you've come to commit suicide. And I said, well, I've already, you know, cheated death once. I'm not going to do it. I'm just here to see the horizon. And she said, just travel with us. You know, come. And eventually we went north to her village. And, it was the only way to travel. So because she knew everybody. She runs a children's house to take in orphans or children from abusive families. And so she knows everybody, and everybody knows her. And there are just no, boundaries between people.
Yeah. Will you read this for us?
Sure. Ice is what Greenlanders longed for and loved. We careened through pavilions and amphitheaters of ice, past mesas that had been halved and rejoined by summer's heat, exposing a central rift that was all azure rubble. As we proceeded north, the ship's wake seemed to close over what was left of time. 1,000 years ago, the hunter's world was made of ice and darkness, water and light, meat eaten raw and dried, and skins, dog, seal, polar bear, reindeer, Arctic hare, and eider duck, that were sewn into clothes, tents, and sleeping bags. The seasons rocked back and forth between light and dark, and the ice was always moving. The top of Greenland is jostled by 52,000 square miles of Arctic sea, most of it ice. Polynyas, areas of open water, were created when surging tidal currents broke the ice and stayed open like unhealing sores in midwinter. The land was an ocean that broke against bodies of water, shattering it into islands big and small. Tides arm-wrestled pack ice until it accordioned up against itself, finally falling onto the mainland shore. Glaciers calved great slabs of ice as big as convention centers and as fanciful as the Taj Mahal, and these sailed down the fjords all summer, their arches, towers, and shoulders collapsing in sudden heat as if from a fit of laughter. Up on deck, I met an old woman who had been napping. She asked if I spoke Danish. Nye, I said. American. A floe exploded on the starboard side, and bits of ice avalanched down into foaming, churning water. Now we are going north, the old woman said, standing at the rail, her chin greasy with seal fat, because earlier she had shared a rack of seal ribs with her grandson. The ice rubble that hit the hull made a thunking sound, and the ship veered. This is not the same world as the one you come from. Even now, you are being deceived, she told me. In early times, the people said the land was thin, and all kinds of talk between things and animals was possible, because all things and all beings were the same. Everything was interchangeable. A pod of ring seals burst out of the water, then dove, leaving in their place a piece of green ice shaped like a harpoon.
The way you describe in the book, and in the article you wrote for Harper's, which is sort of an update going back there, you say they have, these people have this agility on the ice or a kind of knowledge of the ice. And there's a word that I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce.
I probably can't either.
Well, it's the person who is wise about the ice, and it has like 17 letters.
Yeah, that's why I don't speak Greenlandic.
Yeah, so I'm not even going to try, but I wanted you to talk about that, this innate sense of ice and this knowledge about ice. Would you say something about that?
Yeah, learning to be wise about things. It has in it one word. So these are conjoin words, but one word, sila, S-I-L-A, means consciousness and weather and consciousness of the power of nature, but as one thing. So weather and human consciousness is not separated in the way that we do. So to be wise about things means that, in a sense, you've ingested the weather, that you are the weather, and that you've been shaped by ice, but also you reshape the ice because your imagination has been honed on ice. So it becomes, you know, in the best sense, as we talk about climate, a feedback loop that nourishes the human psyche, and the human psyche nourishes the landscape on which it was formed.
I guess it's impossible to overstate how important ice is to them. It's their highway, you say. It's the platform for all the creatures they depend on.
Yeah, it's sort of like you look out of these windows in Utah and you see basin and range. You see land and then you see mountains. So if you imagine that all of that was ice, so that all of our human functions occurred, the farming, the animals, the traveling, the visiting, the houses, were just completely dependent on that place for society to function. That's how the ice is too.
Mm. You know what surprised me was it was 1997, you say, that you first really experienced climate change there. That seems early to me. I don't know why. I'm sure it had been happening, of course, the effects of it for long before that. But 1997,
yeah.
That's your first sense of it. And there's a kind of a great sort of chilling story you tell. Is it Jens Danielsen? Jens Danielsen on this dog sled. And you ask him this great question, are we going to die? Do you remember that story? Do you want to say something?
Oh, I remember
about that. Yeah, I'm sure you
I remember
do.
That story, yeah. Well, we're just trundling along in a dog sled. There were two hunters and me, about 20 dogs. And it was springtime. I believe it was May. There was some snow on top of the ice. You couldn't really see the ice itself. And suddenly there was this huge crashing sound. It was a big sound. And dogs started disappearing in front of the sled. And the hunter on the back jumped off the back of the sled with a big, they call it a tuk, a T-U-K. It's a big piece of metal that you can cut ice with. And he took a seal skin thong and tied the back of the sled to the tuk, which he jammed into the ice to keep the sled from going into the ever larger hole gaping in front of us. And Jens, who's a big man, lay down on top of the trace lines, this is a fan hitch, and hooked his feet on the front of the sled so he wouldn't be pulled in, and started with one arm pulling dogs out of the open water and throwing them over onto the ice. And then he got them all out, and they were sort of on the ice, shaking. And then he stepped off the sled on a piece of ice that was sinking with his weight and was not good. All the ice had kind of broken apart. And he lifted up the front of the sled, which must have weighed 800 pounds, and just dropped it down facing a different direction, yelled at the dogs, and we took off. And, I mean, he jumped on, but unsure of what the rest of the ice looked like.
Yeah.
And we're going along, and, you can see when there's ice that's melting, the line of the runner of the sled just fills with water. And I'm looking down like this, as were the dogs, with one ear cocked down. And it was filling with water. And finally I said in my almost non-existent Greenlandic, "Are we going to die today?" And there's this kind of silence. And then he said, "Imaka," which means maybe. And then nobody else said a word for another 5 hours. But I knew, the great thing is, A, I was in a really beautiful, wonderful place that I loved.
Yeah.
B, I was with really great human beings who would do anything to keep us alive, who were just so skillful at what they do. And so I wasn't really afraid. Mm-hmm. I felt, embraced by them, and that if we all died, well, that was a pretty good way to go.
I mean, you absolutely lived with these people. I mean, there's another story you tell of when you went out with some of the hunters and they were able to kill one walrus early on in the trip.
Yeah.
And that was it. And you had to share this meat, of course, with the dogs, and eventually, if you have to choose between the dogs and the humans, the dogs win out, at least at this particular moment. And I'm guessing you were hungry.
Yeah.
I mean, this was real.
It was all real.
Even this interview is real. Yeah. You know what I mean? I mean, the fact that you were really part of this. I mean, experiencing hunger and intensity.
I do know what you mean. Yeah. Well, that was in, that was in 2004. By then, the ice was really getting bad. So, yeah, I was on a National Geographic Expeditions grant. We had 4 dog sleds, 58 dogs, and 8 humans. So that's a lot of mouths to feed every day. So we were planning to get a walrus or two and maybe some seals every day to also get enough food to take back to the village, because it's a food-sharing society. And so that's why they go hunting, is to bring food home.
Yeah.
Well, we consumed the first walrus in the first week. It was by the time we had they had cut up the meat, and it dropped to about 50 below zero. And so we were just, we were getting hungry. We had to eat. We would eat walrus for about 3 hours every morning just to have enough heat inside ourselves to be able to travel some more, to keep going towards where everybody knows Saunders Island, where there's always great numbers of walrus. Well, the ice was so bad we couldn't even get out there. And then we rested for a few days and we started heading back north just to even get back to the village, and we couldn't even get there. So the weather was bad. We had to go up and over part of the ice cap. And then we went out to some other islands, and it was really, really dicey getting there. And so basically we spent a month getting back home with no food. All the people, when you get back, all the people come down from the village, and the wives and the children, and the first thing we told them was there's no food. And they're so stoic, they're so cool, they just said it's a, don't say anything about it, you just continue on and feed the dogs whatever you have stored there.
But well, there was this thing called village shock that you write about, which is, even though it didn't go well, this particular hunting party, there were still stories and still celebration?
No, I wouldn't say celebration.
No.
Just a quiet, okay. Well, things go wrong very quickly in the Arctic. It's happened. These are people who have hunger in their collective memory, who have cannibalism in their collective memory, who know that when things go wrong, you make do with what you have and you hope for better days the next day. You don't get all freaked out about it. You just carry on. And yeah.
Gretel Ehrlich is with us, writer, poet, essayist, the author of numerous books. We're talking a little bit about this cold heaven. She's the featured speaker at HEAL, Utah's fall party, which is held tonight at 6:30 at the State Room in Salt Lake City. For details about that, you can go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer, naturalist, essayist, poet, Gretel Ehrlich is with us in town this week to talk about the impact of climate change on the Arctic. We've been talking about her book, This Cold Heaven, and an article that really updated the story in Harper's, which came out last spring. So the title for the Harper's piece is called Rotten Ice, which refers to a term from Arctic scientists, a rotten ice regime. Say something about that, if you would. This idea of rotten ice is an interesting image, but really seems to tell the story, I guess.
Yeah. Well, once ice starts melting, it sort of rots. You can see it. It turns gray and it gets all sort of bubbly on the bottom. Well, water begets more water. So it becomes its own kind of feedback loop. That the more ice that melts, the more ice that melts. And because the oceans are getting warmer, and it's melting from underneath as well as on top during the summer months when, we're talking about the ice sheet now, but seasonal sea ice, normally used to come in September and melt at Midsummer's Night around then in June. Now it's just melting and refreezing all the time. There's no, it's
out of cycle. It's out of whack.
Totally.
Yeah. You explain what happens on the top of the world affects all of us. That's what you write in the piece. And I wanted you to say something particular about that, because the stability of the Greenland ice sheet, which is immense, 1,500 miles long, 600 miles wide, and there's this quote from your piece, Kevin Trenberth, who says, "Global warming has fundamentally altered the background conditions that give rise to all weather."
Right.
Put that in perspective for us, if you would.
It's really all about albedo from the Latin alba, which means white. So snow and ice reflect solar heat back into space. So the Arctic has functioned as the natural air conditioner of the world. now that the ice and snowpack, so it's not just in the Arctic, but, you know, all of the northern hemisphere, even including Utah, where you have normal winter snows, that so as soon as the sun comes out, it's, you know, pushing that heat back in. So it keeps our latitudes temperate. Well, as ice and snow disappear all over the world, we have heat sinks, open ocean instead of ice-covered ocean, bare land instead of snow-covered land. It's just absorbing, absorbing, absorbing heat. And so that's kind of the base. So you have global ocean systems that are heating up. So the oceans have heated at least 4 degrees Fahrenheit in the last few years. So that circulates around. And then it sends moisture into the air because it's warm. Mm. And then so Conrad Stephan says, well, water vapor is the most prolific greenhouse gas we have. He said that really drives the environmentalists crazy, but it's true. And so the ocean atmosphere exchange all over the world starts going into action in ways that are so complex that nobody can even, you know, from day to day sort of say, well, this is kind of what's happening. But it creates high and low pressure things. It's affected the jet stream. It's affecting the Gulf Stream. Permafrost is all melting. Methane, the frozen clathrates at the bottom of the ocean are melting because of ocean acidification. So we have methane seeping out not only from the ground where permafrost is melting, but also from under the sea. Methane bubbles have been seen all over the world. So you see it very, very quickly becomes a rotten ice regime.
Yeah. The word glacial, which you always used to think of as slow, it's taken on a completely different context, I think,
yeah,
it seems. You mentioned that in the
hitting
piece.
A new gear, yeah.
Hitting
it fast. Yeah. And you have to realize that the ice sheets are, you know, tremendously heavy things. And as they start calving more quickly, just imagine a big hand pushing down, and so it's squeezing it out the sides and down the cliffs of Greenland, and it's going faster and faster, so the top is getting all sort of looks like a hammer has smashed it.
In 2007, you called this meeting of some of these hunters. Tell me about that meeting. What is it you want to – I guess you were getting at how is climate change, how is a warming planet affecting your lives?
Of course I knew because I'd been living there. But, right. I wanted them to sort of
– You tell me.
Update me. Yeah, tell me what's been happening and, you know, when you've gone out. And it was about the most depressing afternoon I've ever had in my life.
Really?
I invited not only the men but their wives too and anyone else who wanted to come. The women all got up and left in the middle of the meeting. They said, it's too depressing to hear this. We live this every day. We don't want to sit here and talk about it. But one of them said before she left, you know, the ice has become very dangerous. It comes and goes. We never know what it's doing. We are becoming like the ice.
There's this story you tell about the effects. I have to say, and maybe this shouldn't be the case, but for me, like the most telling story was the story you tell of seeing a hunter beat his dog.
Yeah. I'd never seen that in 22 years of going to Greenland. Never, ever seen anyone do anything like that. Not aggressive behavior. Once in a while you have to, you know, kick them when they're fighting or something. But that to me said everything. So it was 2012, I believe.
Yeah.
We were camped out at the ice edge in the spring. There was finally enough ice even to go to the ice edge. It was about 3 feet when we started, and in 2 days it had thinned out to 1 foot. And some other people from Connacht had come and camped behind us, which isn't really kosher. You're not supposed to sort of be in each other's hunting area. But people were kind of desperate to get anything to eat. And we're sitting there drinking tea, and suddenly I hear all this yelling and screaming, and I looked. It was quite a ways away, and this man, older man, had a kind of a snow shovel, and he was just beating his dog's head with it just over and over and screaming at it, and the dog was screeching, and I jumped up and was going to run over, and I don't know what I was going to do. You know, grab the shovel and beat the man. And my friend's Mamret pulled me back. He said, no, don't go. That's dangerous. He might shoot you or something. That's his business. We don't interfere. But he's not behaving properly. So we packed up and we left. And, of course, the ice was going anyway, and we all secretly hoped that he hadn't been paying attention to how thin the ice was getting, and they would just all fall in and not be seen again. The dog actually survived, but it just sort of was described what had happened to the people, that things were not going well, that tempers were rising, that there was depression and suicide, and this just wasn't normal there. It is in other Arctic communities where they have problems that have come on them from the outside, but not in Greenland.
In your piece, you say these are the last days of subsistence hunting. And then the question that comes from that is, what replaces it? Do you have a...
Nothing.
Do you have a, really?
Well, you know, people... my two least favorite words are adaptation and resilience. Hmm. First of all, these are people whose survival tools have been in place for probably 20,000 years since they came over from Siberia and started traveling across the polar north. They know everything about being quick to adjust to, about patience, about generosity, about efficiency and intelligence, you know, traditional ecological knowledge being in place and at your fingertips every minute. So they know all about that. But you can't adapt out of your culture if you're a subsistence hunter who has co-evolved with ice, and you can't adapt out. It's either there or it's gone. So all the young children in Greenland have been sent south, in South Greenland, to learn a trade, to learn to be an electrician or a helicopter pilot or a cook or a school teacher. And these are kids who were raised in subsistence villages where nothing else was going on except to learn to be a hunter, to learn to sew skin clothes, to all the things that are involved with that life. And now they've been sent away. The older people in their 50s are divorcing, committing suicide, moving away. It's really sad.
You went back in 2013 with your husband, Neil Conan. And we'll talk about that when we get back from a break here in a moment. But I guess there's part of you that didn't want to go back. Is it too painful to see in some way what's happening?
Yes, it's painful. It's really painful. We didn't go all the way north where I usually go, so that made it a little easier.
Yeah.
But, I always told them when this began happening that I had come to Greenland. Greenland was a sanctuary to me after I was hit by lightning, and they were so wonderful to take me in. And then I became a witness to the death spiral of, you know, one of the great cultures of the world. And I said, I will always be your witness. I will always try to raise awareness about what's happening to you and to the climate. But there's nothing I can do to help you. I would do anything. I'll do anything to help you in any way, but I can't put it all back together for you.
Gretel Ehrlich is with us, writer, poet, essayist. She is the featured speaker for Heal Utah's Fall Party, which is going to be held tonight at 6:30. It's going to be in the State Room in Salt Lake City. You can get details for that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Gretel Ehrlich, poet, writer, essayist. We also have her husband, Neil Conan, with us now, who, of course, worked for NPR for 36, is that right? 36 years?
I'm afraid so.
Holy mackerel. 12 of those, of course. I'm afraid so. He was the host of NPR's Talk of the Nation, now lives in Hawaii, where he farms macadamia nuts. Also works as a news analyst for Hawaii Public Radio. And Neil Conan, welcome to you. Thanks for being
Good to
with
see
us.
You, Doug.
Well, I wanted to, before we talk about what life is like in Hawaii, let's stay in the Arctic for a moment. I want to ask you about the trip you made with Gretel in 2013. And this was your first experience there. What was your initial sense of it? What was your initial take?
I was astonished. The idea of going to a place where there was a parade, this was a Ilulissat, where we eventually wound up, and it's one of those places where you wake up and there is a new parade of icebergs in front of your hotel room window, you know, as you look up, oh, there's one I hadn't seen before. And it was just a landscape I had never been part of before. The whole, there's no trees. There's nothing bigger than a bush. And the ice comes close to, we were there in August, so high summer. But even so, the ice cap comes down to close to the water's edge in a lot of places, and it's bare rock. There's no place to farm up there. It is a culture entirely dependent on the sea, and dependent, as Gretel writes so beautifully in her books, in most of the year, you can communicate by getting out on the ice, the sea ice, and where it's relatively nice and flat, and with your dogs go to the next village. And that's culture, that's communication, that's transportation, that is the economy. It is everything. And to see all of this shut down in summer in Ilulissat, which is a fairly big city by Greenlandic terms, you know, 5,000 people or so, you know, they have cruise ships coming up to see the icebergs and go to the nearby glacier. And there's that sort of culture. There's the fishing culture, though the when we were there, it was interesting. They had already fished out their quota for halibut, and so they had to shut down their fishery there and were eyeing very suspiciously a big Russian trawler that was going through the Davis Strait. I just never seen a place like that before.
Gretel, what did you want to show him? I mean, you must have been excited to take him to this place that you've been so
engaged. Well, she knows better than to take an Irishman further north of the nearest bar.
Well, he saw his first iceberg. He was pretty excited. He just couldn't believe it. I had to laugh. You know, I just wanted him to see what, you know, the land itself, as he said, is just a big pile of rock. There is no... you know, for an Irishman, a habitable place there. But I think it's that stretch of imagination which you see in all the Greenland stories that you make a place habitable out of what is not habitable. Not only make it, but you thrive there. That's what I wanted to say.
We were lucky enough to get into a plane because we were doing radio stories, so we had a little bit more money than Gretel had when she was up there by herself. So we were able to get into a plane to go over the ice cap and see it. And she was talking about albedo, and one of the things you don't realize is that the ice cap, you think of it as, in your imagination, pristine white. Yeah. It's not. It's covered with ash from the fires that are burning in the forests of Canada that drift over in the ash.
And Wyoming.
And Wyoming. But we can blame the Canadians, you know.
Right.
Blame Canada.
It's dirty.
It's dirty.
Yeah.
And you think of it also as smooth. And as she said, it's fractured. It's all these crevasses as if it's been shattered by a hammer as the glacier moves quickly, as the ice rots from inside and all the water plummets down through the ice and then gets down to the bottom and lubricates the bottom of these glaciers so they flow more quickly. And herky-jerky motions, of course, it's not smooth. And that's what shatters the ice on top.
I want to play an excerpt from the piece you produced when you were up there. This was the moment you were taking a boat to one of these calving glaciers.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of what I love about this piece is we hear. It's amazing how much you can hear ice melting and shifting and moving.
Yeah.
That's kind of surprising.
It was really amazing. It was one of the hardest, as you know, one of the hardest things to record is water to make it sound wet.
Right.
Because it sounds, you know, if you're not putting it in kind of, this is what, you know, it just sounds like white noise a lot of the time. And so it requires a great deal of patience to sit there and wait for the moment that you get it. And we were very lucky as we got up to this glacier.
Whole sections of the glacier face just fell away into the sea. Huge waves now rocking the boat. There's more. Great chunks of ice fell into the water, then raised up again like a broaching submarine to float as small icebergs. With each boom and crack, a bit more of Greenland's ice falls into the sea. And those snaps, and those pops, that's the sound of it melting.
You kind of chuckled there when the wave came, but were you terrified?
Gretel was terrified.
Well, because I've been around calving glaciers, and the boat was pretty close, and I kept yelling at the captain, back up, back up. He was,
and I'm the radio guy. I want the microphone closer, closer.
Right, right.
That's amazing. That popping sound is amazing.
That is the sound of the air that's been trapped in the glacier for however many thousand years, popping out. But it is literally the sound of that ice coming apart as it joins the waters of the oceans and contributes to sea level rise.
There's a great story you tell, Neil, about the kind of the wisdom, the ice cultural wisdom. A man tells the story about the dogs spreading out.
Mm-hmm.
They have a sense of, you know, whether something's treacherous here in the ice.
And telling him what was an ice hunter now who is a boat captain, and that's how in Alulucent, that's how he makes his living. But he takes his dogs out when he can in the wintertime. And he told us that they had taught him, because they know what's going on up ahead. Gretel was telling the story of the dogs falling through the ice. That was probably because they had nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
But he said the dogs would teach him, no, this isn't safe, and this is. And one of the things to realize, again, I think of, you know, dog sleds. I still remember Sergeant Preston of the Yukon, and, you know, you think of the two dogs in the traces going ahead, you know, the long line of them. And in Greenland, it's as you said, it's a fan hitch. They're all spread out. About a 90-degree angle. So they are following each other in a whole different way and are smarter than you and me, believe you me. So it was an interesting thing. He said I'd asked him who his hero was. And the part that I cut out of the tape, he said his hero was John Wayne, because he went to a lot of the movies that were shown even in Greenland. But his other hero was his father, who taught him to trust the dogs.
Yeah. There's a glaciologist that you use in your piece that you write about as well, sort of perceived as an alarmist because he's talking about he likes the word alarmist.
I think he does,
Neil.
Yeah.
Because it's alarming what's going on, certainly. And he told you that 200 to 300 billion tons of ice are being lost each year. And this, too. What that means for CO2 levels, he said, never seen it this high. And the sea level, when the CO2 levels were this high before, which was, I don't know how long ago.
Must have millennia been,
millennia yeah. ago. The sea level was 70 feet higher?
Well, he says 70 feet of sea level rise is cooked into the system we have now. That what we are, if we stop emitting carbon today, we still have 70 feet of sea level. Now, how quickly that happens, who knows?
Right.
This is hundreds of years, probably. But the effects that we're seeing in Greenland and in Antarctica now, those ice caps are going to slide into the ocean and contribute to sea level rise. As the ocean heats up, water expands. And the interesting part about connecting what we did then and where we are now is that the other place that is most directly affected by climate change are the low-lying islands of the Pacific. And I am now working for Hawaii Public Radio and, among other things, covering stories about these low-lying atolls. And you talk to people from Kiribati, the old Gilbert Islands, and Tuvalu and the Marshall Islands, and they say, no matter what, again, if this conference in 2 weeks' time in Paris decides to close every carbon emission immediately, no matter what, our nations will be underwater by the end of this century. And you talk to Jacob de Brum, who's the foreign minister of the Marshall Islands, and he says, this, no matter what happens to us, this is genocide, because cultural genocide, because, you know, presumably our people will go somewhere else, but they're not going to be handed an island to say, to perpetuate their language and their culture. They're going to be broken up, and whether that's in New Zealand or the United States or in Australia or Fiji, but they're not going to be a people, the Marshallese, anymore. And other points that are sort of interesting as you look ahead to this future, does the nation still exist once it's underwater? Do those people still have the rights to the fishing and the mining and whatever it is that's under their waters? Does their nation legally exist anymore? And this is going to be true of those nations, but then eventually, as the water intrudes in other places, of other people. And the idea, we're talking about migrants in Europe now and the problems those people are causing. There are going to be climate migrants. This is not a category. There was a man from Kiribati, the Gilberts, who applied to become a climate migrant in New Zealand. And the New Zealand courts, this was heard all the way through the Supreme Court, and they said, look, there's nothing in the law. You know, migrants, people who are refugees, are fleeing war or famine or other, you know, these things that are specified in law. Climate isn't among them. But there are going to be more and more of these people. And you could look at some of the people, given the droughts in Syria and other parts of the Middle East. Part of what's driving the situation in Europe is climate, because droughts are forcing farmers to cities where they become available to join militias and other things because they have nothing else to do when they are desperate.
It would be so easy to be pretty fatalistic about all of this. And I wanted to ask you, Gretel, about your conversation with E.O. Wilson, which you write about. I've talked to him, and he is always an optimistic guy. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you were being pretty grim with him. Like, what's the point, almost? I'm not sure what the conversation was, but he seemed to give you a sense of optimism. He said, this is our chance to practice altruism.
Yeah, which made me laugh. I said, oh, great. Yeah, we've seen a lot of examples.
Been real good
of
that. At that.
Yeah. Well, first I said, are we doomed? And he said, oh, my dear, of course we're not doomed. But here's what we have to do. We have to put on our suits of armor. I mean, you look at what he said. And we have to change the way we behave in the world. We have to stop acting tribally. We have to stop.
Can I read some of what he said?
Yeah, you read
it's in
it,
here.
Please.
It's beautiful. He said, we have to wear suits of armor like World War II soldiers and just keep going. We have to get used to the changes in the landscape, to step over the dead bodies, so to speak, and discipline our behavior instead of getting stuck in tribal and religious restrictions.
Yeah. And then we get to practice altruism. Yeah. Yeah. But really, you know, we talked about, and in his new book, The Meaning of Human Existence, which is a wonderful short book, just talking about working all together collaboratively and whatever that means.
Yeah.
But yeah.
You do say in your article that what is needed is an open exchange in which sentience shapes the eye and mind and results in ever-deepening empathy. What does that exchange look like? What is that? It's such an interesting idea. I'm trying to figure out how it works.
Yeah, me too.
Are you?
Well, you know, I think that when we talk about – I talk about carelessness has resulted in the climate crisis, that to learn to be a caring person, to have a sense of tenderness towards experience, towards reality, it's you know, taking away – it's becoming like – a Greenlander, where in the traditional sense, where all the borders are permeable, where there's no difference between me and the seal, between me and the piece of ice going by, that, you know, you really actually ingest the whole sense of Gaia, James Lovelock's wonderful books and his also very depressing books about what's happening, that we reintegrate ourselves with the natural world in a way that we can then listen and see what's happening and then act appropriately.
Less than a minute left. Neil Conan, I'll just say we miss you.
Oh,
do you miss us? Do you miss radio? I know you're doing it for Hawaii Public Radio, but I should say that. We miss you.
Well, thanks. You can go to HPR2.com and listen to the Pacific News Minute. But I miss doing the show. I was telling you just before, I don't miss getting ready to do the show.
Right. I know what you're saying. Neil Conan, veteran of 36 years at NPR, of course, the former host of Talk of the Nation, news analyst and a macadamia farmer in Hawaii. Thank you very much for joining us. And Gretel Ehrlich, of course. She's the featured speaker at Teal Utah's fall party. It's held tonight at 6:30 at the State Room in Salt Lake City. There are details on our website. Gretel Ehrlich, it was a treat. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.